So hi everybody, welcome to the second session of the Public Philosophy Manifesto Workshop session. I'm sure we'll have people trickling in, but thank you very much to those of you who've made it here up the street to the Gill Theatre. We're going to begin with a presentation that takes about an hour to read. I just thought I'd let you know so you get yourself comfortable. Its title is A Diluted Manifesto, and it will be performed by myself. I'm Laura Cull, a lecturer at Northumbria University in Newcastle in the northeast of England, by Matthew Goolish, who is adjunct full professor at the School of at the Art Institute of Chicago. He's also the dramaturg and performer for Every House Has a Door, the company that he founded along with Lynn Hickson, who is professor at the Art Institute of Chicago, and she is the director of Every House Has a Door. So, A Diluted Manifesto.
Part 1.1, A Statement of Belief. The discourse held here is that of desire, not of law. The tension, the intensity, I am trying to bring to recognition. The most beautiful styles are the most diluted styles. So I produce something in which everybody has a memory, as if I already had the mold into which the plastic is to be poured. When you unveil it, some people recognize it, though it didn't exist before. A manifesto makes apparent my beliefs. My beliefs hold that for each aesthetic position strongly held, another springs up in equally strong contradiction. In strong contradiction lies the beauty, provided I believe in both, and leave them unresolved and placed in parallel relation. In parallel relation unfolds the flower of dilution. In dilution ticks our measured manifesto. Begin again. To dilute or thin, add water to a liquid. Experience to belief. Voice to voice, and whim to anecdote. We three speak with one voice and with six. Kneel to intellect in our work. Chaos cast cold intellect back, dictate the sound of what is thought. The house was quiet and the world was calm. The reader became the book. Part 1.2, Acknowledgements. Arby is a way of writing the letters R and B, which stand for roast beef, with appreciation by Roland Barthes. Tan Lin touched lightly. Postscript on Philippe Stark. Once described as a producer of fertile surprises. Do inanimate objects have a soul? He complained that passengers ruined his design of the Eurostar by riding while wearing sweatpants. Susan Howe could sing hymns to the sweet hereafter in form of studious harmonium. Every piece of a letter, every shape of a letter, every word, how words are placed on a page. and Wallace Stevens, weather station, worthy specter, nicknamed poetry, that inner companion of conscience.
Consider the following true stories. June 1988. The third International Feminist Book Fair, Montreal. West Coast Métis author Lee Miracle asks the white Canadian author Anne Cameron to move over. 9th of February, 1971. The Chapel, Saint Bernard de Montparnasse, Paris. A low-ceilinged room resembling an American high school cafeteria, located beneath the Montparnasse train station. Michel Foucault is called to the microphone to read the manifesto of the Groupe d'Information de Prison. We propose to let people know what prisons are, who goes there, and how and why they go. This information is not going to be found in the official reports. We will ask those who have some experience with prison. We ask them to contact us and tell us what they know. We only wish to make known the reality and to make it known instantly, nearly day by day, for the issue is pressing. It was Foucault, says Deleuze, who was the first to teach us something absolutely fundamental, the indignity of speaking for others, the indignity of the intellectual who makes a living out of claiming to be a representative of the mute masses. The new intellectual, in contrast, is a militant of the intolerable, a socio-cultural facilitator who uses her privileged access to informational machinery in solidarity with those who suffer most at the hands of majority rule. Those who practice the prison best theorize the prison. Those who act in the reality of the school and the factory are privy to a type of information which is altogether different from that found in newspapers. Leave the talking to those who have an experience of prison, the GIP proposed. And indeed, in 1972, the group moved over to make space for a new organization, the Comité d'Action des Prisonniers, run by prisoners for prisoners.
February 13th, 2010, rehearsal notes. I have lived a long time. I hesitate at the door of the theater. I remember another theater, an assembly hall, a gymnasium. These memories are evidence that I have lived a long time. Hannah Gail Neufeld, a 19-year-old girl, performs these words. She stands in for me, and in doing so, she keeps me alive. How do we stand in for another in a performance and keep them alive? Could we say that when Hannah stands in for me, she stretches to another age, and in doing so, she carries me and those watching along? Hearing this disjunction between the words, I have lived a long time, and seeing Hannah, who has clearly lived a shorter time, speak them, opens up a relationship between two distinct alternatives: living young and living old, and living these together. Perhaps this mystifies, like children catching lice. Heraclitus writes, this mystified Homer, the wisest of Greeks. Homer was mystified by children catching lice. He heard them say, "What we have found and caught, we throw away. What we have not found and caught, we still have." I am thinking here of what happens when making a performance based on something we have not found and still have. Whatever. I use this word in the way Agamben understands it in his book, The Coming Community. Whatever, not as indifference, but based on the Latin translation, being such that it always matters. So now we have the following. A performance, a stand-in, lice, and being such that it always matters. In other words, how do we reinvent attention in a performance to keep others alive, not from a position or a motive, but on an effort to change the way we attend to, look after, or stretch to?
Dear professors, I write to you from within the blackest of despairs, worse than I have ever known before. Nevertheless, I know that I cannot escape by going backward or to the right or to the left. I have no choice. This logic alone is keeping me going. It is midnight. The rain is beating on the windows. And I am dreaming of that never, never land of never having to make choices. It was not midnight. It was not raining. Oh, if only I could escape their ceaseless nagging. Either A is the case or B. If B, then it is not A. Remember, remember the road not taken. Ha, what nonsense. The unpleasant thing, and one that nags my modesty, is that at bottom every name in history is I. I am Michael Sabo. I am also Frédéric Bourdin. I venture to say that I am also Billy Tipton, or Tippy to his friends. You will understand, dear friends, that this does not mean that I belong in the madhouse, nor in the theatre. I'm not just some lunatic who takes herself for Tippy and her tightly bound breasts. But nor am I like ridiculous thespians who take their pale imitations so seriously. No, it means that I am occupying the magical domain we might call the Tipton effect, and no doubt too the Ghoulish effect and the Hickson effect. Of course, you know I love the theatre, but only when the actor has ceased to be an actor, when he realises that it's by trying to be Friedrich that he'll finally succeed in being Samuel. Then all he'll have to do is be Friedrich, which no doubt he shall achieve by trying to be Gilles. Then all he'll have to do is be Gilles, etc. He is something only by being something else, when the copy is no longer a copy, but has become the real and its simulation. Only then will theatre converge on the real, which is not the same as itself either. Remember, reality is what always mimics or coincides with itself only in part. Two roads diverged in a wood, and I found many more roads besides. Zara was right. You can do contradictory, contrary actions together in one single fresh breath. You can linger in disjunction. You can drift in the distance between life and death, child and parent. Yesterday, I broke off all correspondence with my mother. I could not stand it anymore, and it would have been better if I had not stood it for as long as I have. I cannot be this person she wants me to be, a closed box shut off from the man I am, the woman I am, the seabird I am, and I am the advocate of life. One of your letters spoke of the mould into which the plastic is to be poured, but I will no longer be moulded. We are so molded by God and parents and interfering doctors that we find it hard to unlearn this taste for choices and decisions, which truly restrict us at every turn. I, myself, have been too quick to slip into the expected academic mold. But perhaps you have already tired of this shameless manifesto. Forgive me. I am the letter and the pen and the paper. I must write. I must record these nightly wanderings across indecision. I am exhausted, and yet so far from having exhausted all the roads that have opened up within my situation, none of which I have the slightest reason to exclude. Write, please, again, your L.
February 13th, 2010, rehearsal notes. If age could be a feeling, I would say I feel young on the inside. It is the dance that makes me feel young. When I watch it, even at times when I talk about it, I am without age. Now I am thinking about dance. I am thinking about identity as identifying, and identifying as naming, and naming as a way to make a dance. We are making a dance called They're Mending the Great Forest Highway. To create the dance, we name and identify theater, dance, performance art, and a concert. I read that identity formation is a process. It is the development of the distinct personality of an individual. It is regarded as a personal continuity in a particular stage of life. In this stage of life, individual characteristics are possessed. A person is recognized or known by these characteristics. We take this stage of life as a stage where we perform for a certain period of time. On this stage, the identities of theater, dance, performance art, and a concert are distinctly made, each with a personal continuity. These identities form fragments that combine to form an aggregate, and this aggregate forms a combination that forms an event I call a performance. Perhaps it would be helpful to give an example. Agamben writes, "Exemplary is what is not defined by any property except by being called. Not being red by being called red. Not being Jacob but being called Jacob defines the example. Hence the proper place of the example is always beside itself in the empty space in which its undefinable and unforgettable life unfolds. Our performance begins with a monologue made from my rehearsal notes. Hannah Gile Neufeld, a 19-year-old girl, performs the monologue. It lasts roughly 12 minutes. We call this an example of theater. Hannah stands in for me when saying these words. We call this an example of performance art. Then three men, Matthew Gulish, John Rich, and Brian Torrey Scott, perform a series of movements. The structure for the movements derived from Bartok's composition, Contrasts, for clarinet, violin, and piano. Benny Goodman, the famous jazz musician, commissioned Bartok to write it in 1938. Each performer's part corresponds as exactly as possible in timing, dynamics, and repetition with one of the instruments. It lasts 17 minutes. We call this an example of dance. The audience never hears Bartok's music. Instead, they hear Charissa Tolentino play her computer, spin records, and clap. At one point, everyone leaves the stage, and Charissa plays alone for 5 minutes. We call this an example of a concert. So now we have the following: a monologue and an empty space of theater next to it, standing in and an empty space of performance art next to it, three men moving and an empty space of dance next to it, DJing for 5 minutes and an empty concert next to it. In Marilyn Robinson's novel called Gilead, the minister John Ames says that when listening to baseball crowds roar on the radio, it sounds like the soft, almost static sound of an empty seashell. He also says that mention of the sound of a seashell reminds me of a couple of lines of a poem I wrote once. Open the scroll of conch and find the text that lies behind the priestly susurrus. Susurrus, whispering, murmuring, or rustling. The susurrus of the stream. Perhaps if we open our empty performance spaces like unfolding a shell, perhaps if we listen intently like listening to the radio when it is too low, we might be able to hear the audience and the undefinable and unforgettable life next to them roar like a whispering stream.
My perspective throughout the whole of this course is that of desire, not of law. Not a silence that one should reach, but only the desire for silence. Fugitive, but insistent figure of the desire, of the neutral. I describe rather lacks, fantasies, impossibilities, aporias, concerning which there is only one positive thing, i.e., the tension, the intensity, I am trying to bring to recognition by myself. Myself desiring and not a guru. So say the notes of Roland Barthes. I will try to say it this way. Part 2.1, what appears and what does appearance do? A manifesto makes belief apparent, as a theater is a place of appearance, and so we draw a connection. But what appears, or what do we call appearance, in a text and in a place? Does recitation bring the two into coincidence? And if appearance in both instances can be said to be similar enough, can the effects be said to be the same? Words become images, images become words. Spiritus fantasticus, the imagination was the inexhaustible image machine, and were the images it generated modulated by belief or released out of it as uppouring from an underground river? The poem must resist the intelligence almost successfully. Floating like the first 100 flakes of snow out of a storm we must endure all night. Production, like reproduction, becomes a horror of thought becoming material. Victor Frankenstein recoils as his desperate creation pulls open his bed hanging. Such nightmares of belief becoming visible, the imagination rehearses. Consider belief as distinct from action. Action begins in belief, takes flight out of it, and comes to rest in it again. Has the flight revised the belief? Does manifesto speech act? Does appearance in theater constitute action? Or think it this way: does the statement of the belief change the belief? To act out of the belief as stated, to act out of the belief unstated, or to believe out of the action, and to state that. Case study: Loving Care, a performance by Janine Antoni. When I first did it, I was very awkward. The more I did it, the better I got at mopping the floor with my hair, which is a weird thing to be good at. What demarcates between desire and law? Does one imprison the other? If so, when might such confinement be worthy, or accurate, or true? What weather dominates the borderlands? The country is gray and brown and white in trees, snows and skies of laughter always diminishing. Less funny, not just darker, not just gray. We wish light flooded into this century as light once used to do. Part 2.2, Acknowledgements. The new names dropped in this section look something like Giordano Bruno waving goodbye to Italo Calvino with instant coffee. Mary Shelley, my Sharona, I set your track on auto repeat. Charles Sanders Peirce creeps silently past. Janine Antoni, Frank O'Hara, Jennifer Moxley, joyous angels fly over heaven, joyful men. This is not about irony, but authority. Caravaggio painted Matthew taking dictation from an angel. Oh, my laptop screensaver. If the saint kept writing after the angelic voices dispersed, which text might have been the more rational? Part 2.3, unfinished message from the weather station, the worthy specter. Individual poets, whatever their imperfections may be, are driven all their lives by that inner companion of the conscience, which is, after all, the genius of poetry in their hearts and minds. I speak of a companion of the conscience because to every faithful poet, the faithful poem is an act of conscience.
One, a diluted manifesto. The messenger stands in. Behold, I send my messenger before thy face, who shall prepare thy way. And John the Baptizer appeared. According to the observations of Peter Bogatyrev, in his book Magical Acts, Rites, and Beliefs, from his studies in the 1920s, in sub-Carpathian Rus, on August 29th, in order to commemorate the beheading of St. John the Baptist, there was a taboo on eating round vegetables. He was told by a church warden, nothing round can be eaten, no head of any sort, because that of St. John the Baptist was cut off. In addition, it was likewise forbidden to cut anything on this day, because that would recall the beheading of the saint. It was equally forbidden to serve on a dish or plate. One could eat only from a mug, for it was on a plate that they put the head of St. John when it was cut off. In the Rahor archive, this taboo was motivated as follows. On the day of the beheading, it is not fitting to cut in the garden or to slice a head of cabbage, because blood will flow from it. Taken literally, the taboo, just as it was a sin to cut off the head of John the Baptist, likewise it is a sin to cut a head of a vegetable, transformed into the belief, if round vegetables are cut, blood will flow from them as it flowed from the head of John the Baptist. Round stands in for a head. Cabbage stands in for John the Baptist. Slicing heads of garlic stand in for beheading. If words stand in for blood, a messenger speaks. I hesitate at the door of the theater. Hannah stands in for me and recites rehearsal notes. She delivers the words in a flat, impersonal way. She is the messenger, responsible for delivering the text, but not responsible for its content. In Greek lexicon, apostolos means both messenger and apostle. Bruno Gulli writes, Agamben says that Paul describes himself as an apostle rather than as a prophet, because in messianic time, the apostle takes the place of the prophet. The latter speaks of a future time, the former of this time, the present time, the time that remains. The time of the apostle, messianic time, is not that of the prophet and the visionary, apocalyptic time. It is not the end of time, but the time of the end. What interests the apostle is not the last day. It is not the instant in which time ends, but the time which contracts and begins to end, or the time which remains between time and its end. It is the time takes to end. This time, the time of now, the present, whose representation is almost impossible to attain, can only be conceived as a neither nor of time. I hesitate at the door of the theater. I remember another theater, an assembly hall, a gymnasium, and I am thinking, as I have so many times before, of stilling time in a performance, knowing this is almost impossible to attain. The first time I saw Hannah stand in for me in their Mending the Great Forest Highway and read my rehearsal notes written by Matthew Gulish and me, I thought, the monologue is too long. The monologue takes too long to end. The monologue is almost as long as the dance it introduces. This too long seems wrong, and I like it. Hannah the messenger comes before to announce the coming of something. I think of this as a pause, a time to take notice before the performance begins. Only the performance has begun. Like a descendant from classical tragedy, the actor who steps onto the stage and describes the battle, Hannah describes the facts of the dance, its structure, its sources, its intentions, ruminations, and felt facts. It is as if, through announcing all these things first, that we dismantle the work in words before it has begun, and then rise into its parts and gaps when we perform. We have doubled the performance and dance alongside it. All these gestures are material. They migrate across time. A moment, a captured force, like a spirit, flies. It fills and guides a man's body. It makes him move beyond himself, beside himself, and takes the time. Time takes to end. In Daniel Karm's Writing and the Event, Bronislav Yakovlevich writes eloquently about rooms, theater, and Karm's. The secret of a rune is transparency. Unlike a complete building, a rune is never completely closed upon itself. Its structure remains exposed, partially visible and partially not, thus leaving open the possibility of looking through it, of seeing it break apart against its own physical surroundings as in a double exposure. This effect of double exposure is what ties runes with the past. However, Karm's runes resist this atmosphere of decay and melancholy. They belong to the category of what American artist Robert Smithson describes as runes in reverse, the opposite of the romantic rune, because the buildings don't fall into rune after they are built, but rather rise into rune after they are built. What else is this construction into demise, if not theater? 2. A diluted manifesto. The minister rides. Jonathan Edwards rode horseback. He rode alone. He was a minister and rode from parish to parish. It took days and then more days. He rode from Hartford to New Haven. He rode to Boston and along the Mohawk Trail. On this ride, each time an idea occurred to him. He pinned a small piece of paper to his clothing, making note of the location of the paper and his particular insight. When he returned home, he unpinned each scrap of paper and wrote down the thought he associated with it. What follows are scraps of thoughts and their locations as a diluted manifesto. Back of hand. There is uncertainty in belief and belief in uncertainty. Given this, I believe the performance is a social structure, and those making it are participating in civic affairs. Right foot. I remember Henry Zare describing his experience of watching Trisha Brown's dancers slip on and off stage, appearing and disappearing from the wings, inhabiting each other's fleeting gestures. These gestures accumulated in a dizzying way, making it impossible for an element to be present and refer only to itself. This endless circulatory system in performance is also an endless play of difference, identities in motion, identities unmarked, identities on the move beginning with conjunction. Martha Graham was fond of noting, all dance begins as a continuum rather than an origin. Each class begins with and, one, two, three, four. Head, doubt. I doubt expert opinion. Toe. Stand-ins create more self. Shoulder. A poem titled The Thinking Reed. We need more and different flags. What is the worm of the world that spoils exaltation? One who has become all eyes and does not see. To try to understand is to court misunderstanding. Not to know, but to go on. Anything is a mirror. There are two endless directions.
What is this problem of believing and stating belief, of thought and action? The very insight that once brought the world so near now obscures it. The once sharp taste of reality tastes unreal now. Only the prisoner knows the prison. A manifestation of companionship, let us call it that, forestalls the creeping bind. Creativity is the inner companion of public conscience. Build life on belief until the cry of a bird in the pre-dawn darkness jolts and frightens and ruptures the fabric of belief and thus of life. Was it a bird? Was it a cry of something dying? How thin we are, and how thin the space of our encounters. In the wake of the cry, begin to forge the inner response into something called material. Commence the labor of reweaving damaged life. The new version will be no more resilient than the old, no stronger, no more supple, only different. In the corona of difference before it fades, there is no synthesis, only thesis and antithesis, if we choose to call them that, in constant companionship, in parallel. If we hold to two, what might they be or look like? How to bring them to audibility? How to make them visible? The sound of seven balloons deflating. The sound of the cry that precedes the sun. The cry that does not transcend itself. The white pinwheel of the wounded bird, or cat, or self. How might they guide us? How might we live? How might we be not unworthy of what happens to us? Part 3, Manifesto. Our work must be difficult, except when it must be easy. Exceptionally challenging, unless exceptionally transparent. Our work must transport us to a place in which we could never live for longer than a moment, except when it must appear as ordinary as waiting for the bus. It must have a structure that shifts phases as if transporting us to a parallel universe, as if time had leapt, catastrophe, aporia, impossible juxtaposition. It disorients, it rewrites who we are in an instant, except for those times when it appears accidental, all surface and ease and one moment telescoping out of another. Our work must be singular, except for those times when it must be multiple. It must speak of tremendous depth and stillness, except when it oscillates. It must be serious, except when it can't be. It seems I wrote this many years ago, when I was a young man, a weave of layer upon layer, networked, unlikely, obsessive, ecstatic, or else like Dave Wilde's quote-unquote painting. What is that on the wall, Dave? That's my quote-unquote painting. But it's just a green square canvas. True. But last month it was blue. And next month I will paint it red. Or maybe purple. We'll just have to wait and see, won't we? Dave, where are you now that I need you? Somewhere on the shores of Lake Michigan, outfitting a car so you can drive it from the back seat and wave at freaked out pedestrians. Help me write this manifesto. Time is running out. I hope it's clear by now I am speaking from experience. Let me start over. Our work must speak from experience, except for those times of pure imagination. It must intervene like a rupture, infra-thin, resistive, on the fabric of what we call history, except for when it retreats into romance, negative capability, like to the lark at break of day arising, the telegraph wire, the baboon troop at sunset, the landing of the stork when we exclaim, "Mother, Father, I am human again." Now comes the question I nearly forgot to ask. What do I mean when I say I? Who am I then or now? What does this make me? Identity in motion between fixed poles, gravitating to magnetic centers, guided by stars, overseen by animal spirits, through animal doorways, Will my mother recognize me? And what if she does not? And will I know her? And if I do not? There was a place and a time I was born and I was named, and that does not change, does it? Test question number 5. Say I have a problem with your shoes. Perhaps they oppress me, keep me down. I decide to buy the same pair of shoes so that you can see just how awful the shoes are for me, socially, economically, politically, and personally. What am I doing? Which artists come to mind when discussing my decision to wear your shoes? Is my strategy going to make change or not? Please provide both a yes and no to the last question and defend each. Parable of the traffic jam. Not wanting to sit in traffic on the expressway, we diverted to Lakeshore Drive, where we sat in traffic. We took to the loop despite the heavy traffic, which we muscled through to Clybourne Avenue, no better, and so redirected to Webster Street, stop and go, bumper to bumper. We tuned in the traffic watch. There's no safe place out there. The last time it was this bad, I said, was that time Barack came back. And lo, President Obama had again returned home for the holiday weekend. Did the performance duo, Cupola Bobber, have traffic jams in mind when they coined the term soft endurance? Move and stand still, like the multiple overlaid networks in the paintings of Julie Mereau. All potentialities coexist, every alternate route differentiated in complex parallel, in Nash equilibrium, the stalled sum of all surfaces. As Henry David Thoreau wrote in Walden, when working the garden, one does not think of ideas, but of weeds. The only escape from slow is slower. Beloved students, there is no test. Go to the park or library. Forgive me. My teacher died today. A swirling of leaves crowds the mind. A wash of waves beats the brow. I will leave you with this. Creativity, not as conscience, but as its companion. As philosophy is the companion of ethics. Possibility, the companion of preference. Perhaps creativity is the minor practice beside the major practice of the intellect with all its functional structures. Without the companion of creativity, we may come to consider those structures as total. The danger arises then of the ordinary receding into drab background to a plain sense of things, and with it, other people, the rabbit, the bird's cry, the leaves crying, the sunrise. With that confusion, we confuse knowledge with wisdom. The creative reminds us, by taking us back to experience, that knowledge, if left alone, can only lead to more knowledge. But if placed in companionship with experience, it can lead to wisdom. Thought must always be under reconstruction after the creative has ruptured it. No rupture is small. Listen closely to the ordinary and remake yourself always in relation to it. That is your creative work, a companion, a necessary angel to your life. A whistling sparrow in search of a choir. A hand that writes in the shadow of a hand that dictates. Companionship across an unbridgeable interval. The flower and the function of the flower. The four-dimensional volume of the heart as it beats. The underground river with nothing and music in it.
Consider the following true stories. A man is working on his canoe by the river while his 6-year-old son plays alongside him, splashing in the water. As the man works, the boy becomes tired and wanders off along the path that leads back to the camp. When the man finishes his work, he too returns to the camp. But when he arrives, the boy is nowhere to be found. The whole tribe begin to search for him, but after a long time has passed with no sight of the child, they are forced to give up and continue on their spring migration. On their journey, the tribe encounter another clan. One of their elders tells of an island nearby where a boy has been seen lying out on a rock with the seals. Members of the tribe set out in their canoes at once, and much to the joy of his anxious parents, they return with the boy. But the boy has been dwelling among the seals for some time. He will not talk, but only grunts and barks like a seal. He only wants to eat raw fish and has forgotten how to walk. After many difficult months, the parents succeed in teaching the boy how to live as a human again. He learns how to carve canoes and to make bows and arrows. One day, the family decide to go fishing. But as the canoe travels further from the shore, seals swim up and call to the boy, who can no longer stop himself from jumping into the water and swimming off. Saddened but resigned to their loss, his parents threw the boy's box of carving tools into the water after him. Each year since, at the time of the spring migration, the parents find a new and more beautiful canoe waiting for them on the shore, decorated with the swirling lines of the sea. 5th of May, 1971. Cundy's Harbour, Maine, New England. George and Alice Swallow discover an orphaned Atlantic Harbour seal pup whose mother has been shot. The Swallows bring him back to their house and put him in their bathtub and feed him on ground mackerel, which he eats at such a speed that they decide to name him Hoover. Soon, Hoover becomes too big for the bathtub, so the Swallows transfer him to the freshwater pond in their backyard. When Hoover is 2 months old, George hears the seal begin to make some strange noises that sound a bit like words. But he doesn't really tell anybody because he thinks they'd think he was a little nutty. Eventually, though, Hoover becomes too big to stay in the pond. And after a failed attempt to release him back into the wild, the Swallows take him to New England Aquarium. Within a few years, the aquarium staff hear Hoover speaking in George's unmistakable Maine accent. "Hello there. Come over here. Get out of there. Hey, hey, stupid."
Hey, over here. Hey, over here. Hey, 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 hey.
It was Artaud, say Deleuze and Guattari, who taught us that the aim of art and philosophy should be to write for the illiterate, to speak for the aphasic, to think for the acephalous, the headless. But the preposition for here does not mean for their benefit, or yet in their place, they argue. It is before. It is a question of becoming. My becoming headless, becoming seal, becoming Indian. I become Indian and never stop becoming so, perhaps so that the Indian becomes something else and tears himself away from his own agony. Perhaps. The slaughter of the seal remains present in thought, not through pity, but as the zone of exchange between the animal and I, in which something of the seal passes into me. Not the condescension of pity, nor a sentimentality, but a passionate, impersonal, and unnatural participation. Perhaps. Becoming begets becoming begets becoming. And yet I cannot forget that the hunter too imitates the seal's call. A messenger arrives. He says I can stop fretting about whether or not I'm qualified to speak about this. Qualifications, he says, only matter to unimaginative realists. Who's to say you can't talk about medicine unless you're a doctor, if you talk about it like a dog? What's to stop you talking about drugs without being an addict if you talk about them like a little bird? Why should one particular version of reality do all the talking? Remember, he says, the addict's experience can always be produced by other means. To succeed in getting high, but by performing the slowest of dances. As you know, the drugs themselves are the ever interchangeable third that bring first and second into relation. Person A says, I love the way the afternoon light falls on the juniper tree, there by the dry riverbed, at this time of day in October. And person B says, I never noticed that before. And that the next day, person B again notices the afternoon sunlight on the juniper tree by the dry riverbed. And this gives a form and actuality to his relation to person A, a relation which may now be called love. But the third is missing. The link between myself and others has been broken. Henceforth, this link must become an object of belief. It is the impossible that can only be restored within a faith. We must believe in the body, but as that which bears witness to life. We need to believe in this world. We need reasons to believe in this world. And yet the reverse is also true. I am not a believing man. What does the manifesto show when belief itself has been declared false? When it has been said that belief diverts and suffocates effective production. The manifesto then makes clear that my desire is no vague dream. My theatre is a factory where we build new bodies, assemble arrangements of the unrelated, and participate in the different as the only thing we all have in common. We all, seals and canoes, and sea, and dances, and no subtraction, only multiplication. When we write now, we say, we do not know where we are going, but we will have staged petty hoaxes that are a matter of life and death. We will have built an escape route even though we spent the entire weekend sitting round the kitchen table. We will have looked backward to go forward. To name this a collective, being called the Sprout Collective, will prove to have been true. Neither I nor the other is in one place from which we speak. We are in motion. Neither I nor the other belong to a group, a ghetto grounded by an identity, we as women. Or we are, but we are also the reverse. We are all small groups, groupuscules, not subjects, who do not spend a great deal of time embroidering banners, since we are constantly disbanding, burning the old manifestos and writing new ones. When we speak now, we say, we do not know who we are, but we do not speak as representatives. we try to find another voice within our own. When I hear myself speak, I hear the voices of the animals. From the water, the performers call to the audience who are missing. Thank you. Today, you might have heard Francisca referring to the work he's going to present a sample of today, which is entitled Manifesto for Generalized Anthropomorphism. Esther, you're a bit in the dark. Now you're in the light.
More light for the audience, too, if it's possible. Thank you, Laura, for this introduction and for invitation, and for Laura and Beth and all who have organized this session. After a while, we are going to make a short workshop. I will ask you to come join me here on stage. But before that, a short explanation. The aim of this workshop is to illustrate and manifest a manifesto I wrote a few years ago titled Manifesto for Generalized Anthropomorphism. And it was based on my earlier philosophical studies concerning the concept of the stage scene in the tradition of Western aesthetics. My conclusion was that the concept or the phenomenon, this concept, the phenomenon of the stage or scene, has remained unproblematic until our days, because the Western theater, ever since its origins in the ancient Greece, has understood, imagined, and perceived theatrical performance as defined and framed by the figure of the acting and speaking human being. We all have a special kind of a priori scenic understanding, according to which we recognize theatrical situations and can imagine them. That understanding has as its source the phenomenon of acting and speaking human being. This particular phenomenon has originally engaged our experience. To put it briefly, the world is played to us by intermediary of that figure. According to that same understanding, theater is something that is essentially made by human being, a manifestation of her possibilities and limitations. As I tried to show in my study, this is not, however, necessarily the case. The stage or the scene, an actor, an actress, opens by her gesture, can be described and analyzed without taking the presence of the human figure as something presupposed. In the manifesto I wrote a few years later, in 2004, I tried to articulate what consequences this conclusion, if it is taken seriously, might have for our artistic practices. And I won't read this manifesto, I just quote a few passages of it. It has been published in a website journal called Eurozyme. It's available in eurozyme.net. And I have also a few copies of it if you want to read it afterwards. But at the outset of my manifesto, of this manifesto, I state like this. The problem of theater is a problem of the whole Western way of experience. It concerns both being limited to the human figure and the limitations of that figure. It concerns the human figure as the basis and fundamental principle of limitation, of drawing border lines. For the same reason, a manifesto, a call for liberation of expression, is still possible in the case of theater, and that call, in all its simplicity, is the phenomenon of human must be liberated from the human figure. As Francesca described it, this can be understood as a kind of a call for a non-figurative theater, if you like. But how can we get rid of the dominance of the human figure in theater and claim that what is done is still theater? As I suggest, we can continue to agree with Aristotle that theater imitates action, mimesis praxeos. But in this case, the problem lies in how that action is to be understood. Could human speech and action be encountered as phenomena besides and beyond their anthropomorphic restrictions in a state of non-deficient or underdeterminatedness in their unfamiliarity? It seems that we cannot get rid of the human form once for all. We cannot simply renounce a word or replace it without falling back in a dialectical and hence in a very classical relation to it. The human form figure persists on an imaginary level, and this persistence lays also basis for sublime experiences and corresponding fantasies of sacrifice. The same risk is evident also in cases where human form is altered by distorting, fragmenting, mechanizing, or copying or cloning it, for instance. As the manifesto concludes, the phenomenon of human can only be encountered by affirming and advancing the infinite finitude which appears in it. Well, how can this be done? The practical solution here outlined consists of generalizing human figure, not to use and understand it anymore as a means for appropriation, but rather as a means for losing human control and for encountering something else. And I take now a little bit lengthier quote. I lend my human face like a mask to what is not human, and let that non-human be manifested through that mask. This experience does not increase my powers, but this recognition of my simultaneous impossibility and infinite disparity. Through training this perceptive capacity, the human figure experiences dissolution and breaks away from those identificatory attachments to which we have in our perception connected it throughout millennia. In a sense, we go back to thinking and perceiving the same way a small child does, but in this game, which we call theater, we are after something other than a child at play. We are not pursuing to control the world. We do not turn the world into our own image, but on the contrary, attempt to dismantle that too perfect a picture which we have built, so that beings could from now on come to encounter and address us more on their own terms, in all their unfamiliarity, in all their uniqueness, which does not trace back to our definitions of our way of being. Well, this kind of extending of the mimetic forces to their limits, our mimetic capacities to their limits, the factual realization of the Aristotelian idea of man as the most mimetic animal, mimeticotaton, can finally turn into an ethical claim. And I quote, "The human being has a peculiar right to imitate other beings that she encounters in the world, to participate in other experiences. From now on, this right would be turned into our duty." The idea here is one of practicing rebirth, recognizing one's own being born, naivety, which has always been a characteristic of excellence in art, does not equal gullibility or childishness. Instead, it is encountering of the phenomenon and affirming it beyond all prejudice and prefixes, evoking the uniqueness and beauty of its very own existence. To do this in the human case means going beyond the human by following and strengthening the abysmal movement that arises in us. This reaching outside of the human figure is neither progress nor a project. It is encountering something unfamiliar and non-human and opening up to it. It is openness to words, other forms and shapes and experience in the universe, some of which are less complex compared to the human form of existence, others far beyond it in complexity. And I conclude. The manifesto concludes. Human hope lies beyond all restricted anthropomorphism, behind everything that calls itself humanism. It lies in the decidedly non-human. What we encounter as its most beautiful in other humans is something that always goes beyond us. Humans can only rely on what we are not. We are safe to trust stones, plants, animals, the sea, earth, and space. Only against those elements can we encounter, understand, and regain the uniqueness of our own experience. Well, on that basis, after I wrote it, this manifesto, I gathered a group called Other Spaces, where in a very explicit way we tried to answer to this call. I presented first to myself, but to all my colleagues, to you, to us. And the working principle of our group was exercise as a mode of performance. We invented collective bodily exercises by means of which we seek for contact with other modes of being and experiences than human. We visited other spaces. In these exercises we turned into, for instance, into mountains, into clouds, snakes, into seals, radiation, gastropods, and so on. And the principle was also that they would be so easy that anybody could do them. And this is also my hope today. I would like to invite you to realize one exercise here together on stage. You are free to participate, but I ask all of you, first of all, to come closer so that if you observe what is done here, it would be easier, and it would be easier also for those who participate. So please, let's conquer the stage. You can leave your bags, perhaps. So you can sit around them. Thank you.
how to do it. Okay, the idea is to animate a tea. It is very, very easy. It is done by rolling it on the floor by the tip of your finger. All right? And after you've been doing it for a while, something happens. Suddenly, it looks as if a pea is rolling freely and you are just following it. These are hypotheses. These are important moments because then there is communication between you and the pea. He has received from you something of your a kinetic ability, your soul perhaps, and you have received something from the pea in exchange. What is it? You can reflect on it. And we shall reflect it together. But these are the precious moments, and they don't last long. But we try to reproduce them over again. So that is the most important thing to do. Okay. Some additional instruction. All the pieces are individual. So, like in a playground, if a fellow do not want to play with you, you take another fellow. So, I advise you to take a few pieces and choose the one in order to find the one who wants to play with you. Some of them might be reluctant, but well, you make a variation. Another advice, you can move it by any part of your body, all right? Not only finger. I recommend to make variation massively. I recommend especially to roll it with your nose, because it is very rare that you have an occasion to roll a pea with your nose. And you can also blow it, but you understand that it's, of course, a special effort. And still one thing. After you have been doing it for a while, please stand up and look around what the others are doing and what is going on, and then go back and change this point of view every now and then. We can discuss freely important is that we do not disturb our concentration. It is important for your experience that you make a distinction that is clear enough between your action and your reflection. And you can take away your shoes if you want, but you don't need to do it. So, is this clear enough?
Yeah.
Okay. And let's work like this. For maximum 6 minutes, and I'd say when we finish and we return the piece to the set.
We're going to conclude all this weird stuff by being practical, by being pragmatic, by getting real. I call this piece the Manifesto Manifesto, or How to Craft an Asshole-Proof Upper House of the U.S. Congress so that progressive legislation can actually be passed. Yesterday, I gave a really scintillating paper in which I tried to educate everyone about the essence of the manifesto as a genre and as a generalized practice. But because I think critical practice, philosophy, public debate, and pretty much discourse in general are all part of a derivative false consciousness generated by the superstructure, and by superstructure I mean the lamestream American media, I really don't think any of that matters so much, which is why today I'm going to actually manifesto. So, just to be clear, this manifesto is real. It is really a manifesto, and the manifesto is real. The etymology of manifesto can be traced back to the Latin manifestare, which means to put your cards on the table, to reveal, to disclose or clarify a model for a just society that you're happy to pontificate about but unwilling to personally implement or maintain. It's also from the Italian manifesto, which means to publicly piss people off because you're smarter than the people who watch Fox News. It's true. And you wish they would all just get the hell out of your country or go start a righteous commune in Sarah Palin's house so they can enjoy the redistribution of oil wealth via state oil royalty checks and monitor Russia. Because as Putin rears his head and comes into the airspace of the United States, where do they go? It's Alaska. So we can monitor Russia from our backyard together and maybe have some sportsmanlike fun hunting wolves from a helicopter and tell each other they've done a heck of a job. And that definition is from 1644. So my thing with the manifesto is that the levels of vitriol that render public discourse toxic, divisive, and utterly dysfunctional signal the fact that we need a new manifesto. Specifically, we need a heroic, aspirational gesture of interdependence, a ritual of belonging where we reaffirm our high-minded commitment to fostering the mutuality of being while also avowing dissent and the proliferation of difference. We need a koan. We need a charismatic talisman that we can repeat. To bind us in a ritualistic fashion and create a sense of communitas whereby we can experience this sense of co-presence without violence. Now, I want to give some examples of other talismanic phrases that have been tried out in the past to kind of foster this kind of condition of relationality. For example, we believe in one God, the Father, the Almighty, creator of heaven and earth, of all things seen and unseen. We believe in one Lord Jesus Christ, the only Son of God, eternally begotten of the Father, God from God, light from light, true God from true God, begotten, not made, one being with the Father. Through him all things were made. For us men and for our salvation he came down from heaven by the power of the Holy Spirit. He was born of the Virgin Mary and became man. For our sake he was crucified under Pontius Pilate. He suffered, died, and was buried. On the third day he rose again in fulfillment of the scriptures. He ascended into heaven and is seated at the right hand of the Father. He will come again in glory to judge the living and the dead, and his kingdom will have no end. We believe in the Holy Spirit, the Lord, the giver of life, who proceeds from the Father and the Son. With the Father and the Son, he is worshipped and glorified. He has spoken through the prophets. We believe in one holy Catholic and apostolic church. We acknowledge one baptism for the forgiveness of sins. We look to the resurrection of the dead and the life of the world to come. Amen. Example two. I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all. Example three. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Example four. Il n'y a pas dehors texte. There is nothing outside the text. Example five. Monism equals pluralism. Now, obviously, these are all careworn examples whose rhetorical force has been corralled into the service of the hegemonic liberal state. And anyway, the content of their rhetoric covers over the non-identity of the imminent lines of force they deploy in order to realize themselves as themselves. And anyway, what difference does it make what we say? Nothing really changes, even as everything stays the same. Nevertheless, we can find a gestural saying together that won't be vulnerable to such co-optive forces and such obvious pitfalls. And our authority to do so is equally obvious. People will want to repeat our mantra with us, and our newly conceived mechanisms of interrelation won't become bureaucratic or riddled with corruption or hierarchized or colonized by lobbyists or become anti-theoretical or anti-intellectual or guarded by walls dotted with gun towers to keep the immigrants out or invite endless rounds of filibustering. We won't have to resort to violence as a means of safeguarding our new society of mutual being from assholes. Our heroic aspirational gesture of independence will be asshole-proof. So, together, here, today, let's manifest the thing that will obviate the need ever to manifest again. We have nothing to lose but the rock that we continually push up the mountain, only to roll back down to be pushed up again. This is all true. God bless Performance Studies International.
If anyone has any responses or feedback or comments about any of the presentations, feel free.
Matthew created a structure such that each one of us writes 300 words, 600 words, 1,200 words. Then we randomly selected an order to put those pieces into a whole. We started from the premise that we wanted to try and write a statement of belief and then a contradictory statement of belief and then a third statement that was not the synthesis or hybrid of those two statements but the becoming of the first two. Whether or not that structure is what happened is another matter, but that was the starting point.
And was it always imagined to be a very text-focused performance? I mean, obviously, if I were to imagine as a text, but the way that it was staged was very, very static, and I got the sense that it was in order to focus as much as possible to the words and what the people that were speaking.
I think that was intentional, partly because we knew we wouldn't have time to rehearse. It was the randomization, the piece was always in three parts, all the short sessions, all the medium sessions, and all the long sessions. And what randomized was the order in which the three of us spoke within those three sessions. And it was loosely based on a John Cage composition called Inlets, which follows the same structure, and also the drone intervention came at a point where he calls for a drone intervention, and that has a sort of just release valve. And I think all of those strategies were, in this case, used to make the words or allow the words a higher degree of digestibility, just to sort of make it easier to listen to, or like you said, allow you to concentrate and focus on the words, and also to sort of facilitate whatever accidental dialogues might arise or deliberate ones between the parts.
I was a little bit late, and I felt like I was entering too late to be not being concerned, but I didn't have to focus on it too far, but I didn't have to focus on it.
That was
okay.
There's also the way Paige talks about that particular structure is one of settling down into the work.
Yeah.
So all the short sort of pieces are getting progressively longer, sort of facilitate this sort of slow absorption into the world.
Yeah, I just want to say that having only experienced John Cage on tape, I'm really interested to know if that's your model. I also came in late and wasn't sure what was going on when I came in. I found it just really moving in an interesting way. And I think it was because I really started listening, you know, because you were doing things. And so the words really struck me in a way that I didn't think they would when I was thinking that I was ready.
I'm not sure where this is. When you were setting up the stage piece, you mentioned something about, in a way, that I'm raising these with our movement and they bring it back to us. Mentioned that these magical moments are few. I just wanted to know other examples of magical moments of this type of meditation. What do you think of all other kind of things? I imagine kind of older kid movies with great thoughts going down the toes. There's two of them on the side of your head. I'm pretty magical, but you know, it's. Or maybe that's too close to the model of the feeling, or something else.
That's why I wanted to know where I wanted to accentuate this happening. It's not about the universe experience that you have in itself, that has to be repeated and reproduced over again. And that is the really good exercise that is the repetition.
This idea that Simone Weil says that culture is
I just noticed that the key that I settled on, that if I could propel it with a certain degree of force proportional to its size, that it rolled in, it almost seemed like grounding motion, like this totally irregular syncopated way. It was just completely unexpected.
No, I tried to do it fast. It didn't work every day.
Lost that. So it was always a matter of trying to. And so then the idea of trying to keep it moving was extremely difficult because of its irregularity.
Yes.
Riding with the blade.
I wonder if you
would
ever take the manifesto into a manifestation.
Yes, we've been performing, demonstrating and teaching these exercises and constructing performances based on this kind of pedagogical studies. And, but you know, the curious thing is, in fact, when you have as your as the basis of your work a manifesto, every time you do something, it's totally related by this. They become manifestos, and for the same reasons they become performances. In a certain way, there are certain needs and openness. And yeah, once again, it is a theme of a matter of recognition.
Because I've seen some of I've tried some of the exercises before. I think this was, but I haven't seen this one, and this was very, very fascinating because of the theme. So what made you, because some of the earlier experiences were about magic, or using only your own body. So this choice of a small material, existing object outside your own body, how did you come to that? Was it sort of by experimenting with different material things, or was it just because of the size of something small? Because I think that's a real quality difference, which makes it really interesting to have something outside the body.
Yeah, that's the problem we work for secretly training camp, and this was one of the preparatory exercises we did. We suggested before entering the more, let's say, complex exercises. But it is a question of body.
So again, I just ask you, what do you mean by similar or from these exercises?
Witnessing their work, the work of the group, which have been very different in character, without, because they have been like using your own hand, liberating your own hand.
Yes,
that's what I mean. So the exercises have.
But in more complex ones, there is the same structure, and what is important is this empty space between the body of the being and your tip of your finger. I think it's important. What Matthew said was interesting to hear. As you said yesterday, that Imapani has a particular capacity to get integrated with several kind of systems. But at the same time, or any kind of systems, but at the same time, there's a certain kind of ideology that makes a distinction between certain levels of experience and a certain human perception. I mean, for instance, in science and in economy, there's a tendency to create the spheres of reality that go beyond human imagination and understanding, or at least they say so. And the human experience is beforehand somehow restricted, and there are dimensions opened that you can access only by means of, for instance, some mathematical models or
and so on. And we really the series of certain mimetic dispositions we should resist to that, that we should somehow make those dimensions accessible to us or integrate our bodies to those happenings, whether they really molecular or really cosmological.
Well, yeah, we're tired. It's my husband, I can't say no when he wants to ask a question.
Just to your performance piece, I was wondering, like, we were talking yesterday about irony and manifesto, so I'm sure all people very heavily intonating your voice to give a sort of sense of irony. But you put a set of credos, religious, political, and then philosophical, all on the same plane. Mm-hmm. Like starting off with one that one might imagine from a left-wing perspective, ones that might be more critically approached, but then Derrida, then Deleuze, as though any statement of belief has either you take an ironic distance from all of them because they are statements of belief, or that because they are formulas, therefore they have some kind of a totalizing effect. And I was just wondering, in your own performance, I think Matthew once said something like the statement of a belief changes a belief. Is that line in there? Is there something about beliefs or the statement and formulations of belief that were?
I think, you know, I was thinking about them as hooks to kind of hang your coat on, I think, as a way to kind of orient, a means by which different communities attempt to find a thing sayable such that they will be oriented toward the good and they can renew that orientation and come back to it and repeat it, whether it's at conferences every year, whether it's in publications and citations, whether it's, you know, at a ritual gathering like a church ceremony. You know, trying to find the thing that will make us feel like we could say the thing that will then also bind our sense of co-presence with one another in a positive, affirmative way. I guess it's a means of checking in on the time clock and saying, oh, I don't like that metaphor, but saying, here I am, I'm here with you. These things that we say, shared bits of language that then signal, I am here with you, I'm here to be with you.
But the irony, if it was there,
I wasn't trying to be ironic. I go to a Catholic church every Sunday and repeat this statement of belief. And I have a very complicated relationship towards that speaking. But what I know is that I have yet to find the thing that I can say that I can never I can never find any of the kinds of problems of organization and the dangers of the different kinds of, whether it's symbolic or literal, different kinds of exclusions and violences and oppressive forces or enabling forces that hierarchize certain people to be enabled and others to be less so, methods of legitimation. I haven't found that thing that I don't have a problem with yet. And so that's why I'm trying to put them in conversation with one another rather than separating out some credos that somehow magically draw up the best in people versus some that seem to only draw up the worst.
Thank you, everyone, for...